saying that Sergeant Sparks had used his water from his radiator for washing and
shaving,
putting it back again. Did you do that sort of thing as well?
No, I didn't think of that. We used just to be dirty. We never washed and shaved unless we got water there. We didn't use it at all. Simply Sparks probably was a nice, smart-looking troop. I don't know. Of course, they probably only did it about once a week or something like that anyway. When the supply vehicle did come up, occasionally, they'd issue cigarettes. And they would be a tin of 50 for each person in the squadron. And they would be these Victory V's, they were called. Never having smoked in my life, I couldn't sort of say what they like, but from the general opinion was they were pretty rubbishy stuff. And of course, my driver and gunner were both heavy smokers, and of course their cigarettes had gone in 2 days. You know, it was more or less chain smoking. And I remember one day I was up in the turret, you know, looking out sort of through my binoculars, and suddenly from the fighting compartment up came a plume of smoke. You know, God, what's going on? So I dropped it down and said, what's going on? And of course it was Ernie Bates and Maggie Webb were both smoking. What they'd done, they'd run out of cigarettes, so they got a signal pad, and they'd got some camel grass and, you know, that sort of scrub, and they were smoking that, you see. And I know why, you see. They were dropping a hint to me that they were out of cigarettes, you see. So I said, well, what are you smoking? What's this? And they told me. I said, oh, yeah. So after a while, I said, oh, I didn't realise you were out of cigarettes. Have one of mine, you see. And so I would ration them, and I'd make my cigarettes last, you know, about 5 or 6 days by giving them one when I thought it was really needed, when they were desperate. And that's how we used to go. But that was a pretty good hint they gave me anyway. But you could have sold a packet of those, a tin of those cigarettes, you could have sold for £100 if a person who had money. They were like gold dust to people who smoked, you know, who enjoyed a smoke.
Did you ever start?
Never.
You must have been a very small minority.
Probably, but I never had smoked. I'd always been keen on sports. You know, I used to, before the war, I used to train for athletics and box all through the winter. So I never wanted to smoke, had no desire to smoke. And I'm glad I didn't, really. But,
did the army at that time encourage people to smoke?
I don't think it was a case of encouragement, but I know there used to be so much on the ration, because they couldn't buy them anywhere, and they had to, I mean, it's good man management, isn't it, you know, if a man's desperate for a cigarette in those conditions after being bombed, the first thing he'd want to do probably was to light up a cigarette if he had one. But they used to go for so long without them coming up. So it was a case of, because when the ration law used to come up from, wasn't until much after this time, we used to start getting a vehicle come up from the PRI. You used to go down to Cairo or nearest base and buy up all the goodies, tins of fruit, anything, you know, and cigarettes. And of course, the soldiers who smoked used to buy sort of 400 or 500 cigarettes and keep them in the bin and smoke like billy-o. But that wasn't until well after this period, because this period was the worst time on the desert, because the supply line was so long and we were so. There was no organisation, and I think so we weren't, all we were getting, the basic things, was ammunition and petrol. Food, all it was bully beef and hard biscuits, margarine, tin bacon, that salty tin bacon. No good, tea, sugar and tin milk. Nothing else. I mean, I think once I remember, it was much after this time, some bread came up, and we were amazed. And of course, when it got to it, it was all green, mould, and you know, you couldn't eat it or anything like that. And then they, one time, they sent up some lime, you know, these little lime fruits, because they reckoned that was good for your health, I suppose, rather like
prevent you against scurvy
and scabies and that, because we all, most of us, got scabies, you know, just after this, all around this time, people were getting scabies, they were getting desert sores, big ulcers on the legs, crabs, lice in some places, you know, because there was no water to wash. All we used to have to do was to wash ourselves in petrol. If anyone had crabs or anything like that, you'd see them washing down in petrol. Because you know, you can't imagine really going for a couple of months without a good wash.
Do you think that these deprivations affected your performance?
Well, no, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. No. It's a case you got on with it, and everybody was sort of... I think it was a good regiment. They were well trained. You know, everybody could do each other's job. And you had a lot of pride in your regiment. And you were individuals, you know. It's not like 50 men all being told to do something by a second lieutenant. When you got in your armoured car, the three of you, you were three individuals. You were left to your own thoughts and how you survived. You didn't have to rely on anybody else. I know you had a troop leader who used to say, well, this is what we got to do. But once you were in your own car, you were a free agent, more or less. And that helped a lot. I think, you know, and whereas you get, say, 50 men all together, you get one who was a moaner, and he could turn a lot of the others sour. But in an armoured car, you couldn't get anything like that. So it was a great thing, really, I think. So, anyway, that was the cigarette business. Oh, they came up. Well, I mean, you used to get each troop ration used to come up. There'd be nine tins a buoy, so many packets of so much of this, so much of that. Water, 2 gallon, or it should be 3 gallon. Whatever came up, you'd divide amongst the three armoured cars. And there'd always be nine men in an armoured car, nine tins of cigarettes, that sort of thing. So. But they didn't come up very often. I mean, it wasn't a weekly thing. It might be a monthly thing. You know, so some of the poor chaps who smoked, they used to be in a hell of a state, I think. But it was because they had to come hundreds of miles over rough country, you know, and of course some of the lorries, they had their breakdowns and whatnot. So, but there was, as I say, never any shortage of petrol or ammunition.
But you were really right at the end of the line of
support. We were right at the end. And sometimes we were so far ahead, and then we had to come back in order to get our supplies. Because if we were sort of 20 mile inside, which we thought the German line, you couldn't send a supply lorry up there. You had to come back to the supply lorry. But we always, when we went on patrol, you see, we would always drop back and join a squadron leaguer. So if we like Matt and I sometimes sort of gone 20 mile ahead into the enemy lines, the other troops might be over to a flank where they couldn't have gone the way we did. Then we would all drop back at night and form a leaguer. We would never sort of leaguer out there unless we were forced to.
There's an operational condition that required you to?
Well, you A, for safety, you know, if you know you'd gone right in the middle of the enemy line somewhere, it'd be a bit foolish to camp overnight, because by the morning you might find that you're in the middle of an enemy leaguer by dawn. See, so we always came back to which we know was a safe area, and also to replenish petrol and get any fresh orders. And get a bit of sleep.
Roughly how much sleep did you need to keep going, do you think, as a minimum?
Well, when at times, throughout the war at times, you would, if you got about 4 hours sleep, you thought you had done well. Especially in Italy, in the summer.
Short nights, presumably.
Yes, I mean, it'd get dark at 11 o'clock at night, you'd come back off your patrol, come into Liga, you'd have to replenish, do your maintenance, or fill up with petrol, ammunition, cook yourself a meal, perhaps, and that, get your orders for the next day. By then, it'd be nearly midnight. You'd put your head down, 4 o'clock next morning, you're out. Of course, by five, it's broad daylight, isn't it? So if you've got about 4 hours, that's going to be what it was. And I think on the desert, it used to be a little bit longer, because it used to get dark suddenly. And but I reckon if you got, you could keep going. If you got 6 hours every night, you were doing very well. You could do, but you could manage on four. Which that's what you got used to. And of course, sometimes, like the driver, he could catnap. So he was all right. If he was sitting in a position and you were keeping your eyes open on there, the driver could be asleep. It doesn't matter. His job is finished. He's just got to drive. The gunner also, he could be sitting at his guns and he could doze off, you see. But the commander had to be sort of on the alert all the time. And I think it's a matter of what you get used to. Like all training, really, isn't it? I find even now, if I just get 6 hours sleep a night, that's plenty for me. Oh, wow.
How long were you in this area around El Hasset from the salt marshes?
I think it was round about. I did give a date when we.
It was early in 42,
wasn't it? Yes, it was about just after. Would it be about the 4th of January time or something like that, would it?
I think you said something like that, yes.
I think somewhere around about that, but I know on the. Well, we were still there on the 17th of January. Of course, we were escorting Jock Campbell.
This is the man who came up with his infantry battalion.
That's right. We went round with him to all the forward positions. They were manned by the infantry. And of course, that was on the 17th of January. And of course, I don't know if it was his red hat or what, but we attracted a lot of shell fire and machine gunning. And also, some of the Stuka bombers came down in that area. I think it might be because that was an infantry position which attracted, as opposed to us escorting Jock Campbell around.
Did you see anything much of the enemy?
No.
Between the wreckage forward?
No, no, no. The only times you saw the enemy is if you happened to get close enough, because they'd always be sort of out of sight. The odd anti-tank gun, you wouldn't see that until you were close to it, because that used to be sort of dug in at low level. And also, you used to find it very difficult, not only in the dust storms, but the haze you used to have on the desert. When you were travelling, you know, your visibility used to sort of be down, sort of like the mirage effect. So it made it a bit tricky to see things. And if you got too close, you'd be fired at before you got a chance to have a real look. But when there was movement, and you could definitely see movement, then you could record what it is. I think there's a case of just going on until you bumped the enemy, but you couldn't give a figure. You could say, oh, it's tanks in the area, or that's soft vehicles in the area. You couldn't sort of give a number, really.
Because to do that, you have to
get too close. Occasionally, you see a number, you know, if they were on the move and they were going across, say, on the track or something, you might be able to count as 10 tanks, 20 tanks, something like that. But there's very rare occasions you've got that.
Did the enemy have static defensive positions forward of your own?
Not static. They're always sort of, they're either doing a rear guard action
or
they're moving forward. There is never a sort of a permanent thing until you've got to places like after Alamein that there were different lines they held.
Like the Marath line.
Marath line and all those. They'd be a static thing. But
we had a static defence, presumably, if the infantry were dug in at that time.
Not a permanent one. They'd, again, if we weren't going forward, we were running back until we got to places like Knightsbridge and Alamein, and then you had a definite front line and a static position. But other times they were hastily prepared positions they would do.
The Knightsbridge box, that was a fairly...
Oh, that was a prepared... they were a prepared position.
Yes.
You see, because that was in the Gazala line. Mm. You see, and minefields all around. So that was the static place, and also at... Alamein, they're about the only two which were really static positions. The rest of them were quite fluid.
It was Tobruk too, that was...
Well, yes, that was behind the Gazala line.
Yes.
And that was there as a port that was completely defended and surrounded by minefields and whatnot. Of course, that held on after everything else had gone and it was defended right up until it was relieved, wasn't it? Which was before, on the first time back, I think, Tobruk held, and they kept it until it was relieved after the push, which when we got to Benghazi. So it's, that was on the 17th of January, we got back to our squadron leader. And the supply vehicle had come up from Cairo, loaded up with all goodies. And our first lot of mail arrived as the first mail we'd had since we left England. So that was 4 months we'd been without any mail. And so I got my first air letter. You know, they were these little... they call them aircrafts, were they?
Aerograms.
Aircraft letters, that's right. The little things. And I got one of those, as my, and all the other people in Scotland. It's the first mail they'd received since, it was on the 17th of January, since leaving England in October, I think. Yeah.
Was it just the one letter you got?
I think there might have been a couple, but the same things, you know.
Same things?
Yeah.
Had you had a chance to write anything to send back during the time you
Yes, you had these sort of little cards you could send off, you know, I'm alright, you know, I'm...
We just crossed out...
You crossed out the things, yeah. But, apart from that, there was... We never sent any...
You didn't carry stationery in
no,
cards?
No, no, no. signal pads,
signal
you know.
Pad.
Yeah, but no, we didn't... Not until we could get back somewhere and really write, you know. Because if you had it, how did you get it back? You didn't have any, didn't have stamps, you didn't have any way you could post it. So, you know, it wasn't worth the bother.
You were out on the limb.
That's right. But when that lorry arrived, you see, he had tins of fruit, so everybody could buy a tin of peaches or pears and things like that. And I can see Matt Abraham now. And that was a cold night. He had his overcoat up, collar up, and he had a tin of peaches, and he was scooping them out with a spoon, you know, eating these. I mean, it was fantastic to get a tin of peaches after so long without anything. I mean, it had been, probably on the boat when we had something like that. And so everybody was allowed one tin. And so that was really great.
Was it all peaches?
That was peaches. There was peaches. There was pears. There might have been plums as well, I think. But that was about the limit. And cigarettes. People could buy cigarettes. And soap, I think. Well, that was a waste of time anyway.
Well, without the war
But that was the sort of thing that the PRI lorry had come up and booted with. Oh, and sweets, tins of sweets, which were good to have.
I suppose sweets do provide energy, don't they?
So oh, yes.
What sort of sweets were they?
Sort of barley things barley in sugar. The tin, barley sugar, that sort of thing. So just happened to what the PRI sergeant bought at the NAFI, and his name was Stammers, Sergeant Stammers, who came up with it. He was calling him Kid Millions.
You mentioned buying things. Did you get issues of pay while you were out in the field, or did you just leave it to build up?
Oh, you left it to build up. You could get pay, I think, once in a while, but it's pointless because you were never together to draw it. I think when we came back, when all the regiment was together, then you could draw pay if you wanted.
What would you spend it on?
You couldn't, apart from a PRI shop that would come around, or if you went back on leave. So really, I can't remember when I drew any pay. I knew when I went back to Cairo I drew some. I think the whole of the pay for that period I drew. And I think that all disappeared in Cairo.
4 days?
In 4 days,
so
yes.
That's 4 months pay,
yeah.
Is it? In 4 days?
Yeah.
Must have been a hell of a party.
Yeah. Well, you stayed at a hotel.
Cairo was expensive.
Well, not only that, I think we were conned as well. We stayed in a hotel. Once we got back to Cairo, we booked into a hotel and sort of then had haircuts and shampoos and so sort of luxury things. Went out to have meals in lovely hotels and could get some nice ice cold beer and really went round all the sites of Cairo. But then we went into shops and bought stuff, gave them the money to send it home, gave the post as well, paid for everything. None of it ever got home. Never. None of it. And whether probably the shops knew, oh, well, they won't know the difference. And because we used to, have lots of money, and so I'd say, oh, yes, send that. Presents to, all the different friends or whatever. And because it all disappeared.
I think you were robbed.
Oh, we were robbed, why?
I mean, the shop was probably gambling on you not coming back.
Oh, yes.
Or the Germans winning.
That's right.
Like that,
yeah. And they could say, oh, we sent it. It was probably sunk. There's no
ship torpedo.
That's right. Anything, really, there's no proof. You just relied on them sending it. But there it is. We were young, we were innocents. And we're getting away from our...
Yeah, so you're still in the Alhesset area of the salt marshes.
That's right.
You're on the 17th of January. Mm. You've been there now about a fortnight or so.
That's right. And that was the 17th of January then. Oh, by then, the day after this ration thing came up, we moved out into positions, but we got the feeling that there was a big attack imminent from the Germans. They'd been building up, and there were signs from different information that things were happening.
How did you get that information? Did it come round official, or was it rumours?
Well, a lot of it was our own idea of, you got a sense with the activity, that might be quiet, there's nothing happening, what's going on? And you had a feeling that, an instinct that, things are too quiet.
In other words, they were being active but taking care to
that's
conceal
right.
the activity.
That's right. And you had that feeling we had that... This is too quiet to be true. They're building up. And we came to expect that we'd only got so far, and then there was resistance. You see. So you say, right, we've got to that now. The alternative is now, he's, our lines of communication are so long, he knows that we can't get reinforcements up very quickly.
Because you were really overstretched.
Oh, we were overstretched. And so the thing was then, his line of communication was so short, he could build up and suddenly jump. And that was the case, I think, in lots of the battles on the desert, that the lines of communication were the ones that controlled the winners or the losers.
Well, it's said that logistics determines what is strategically possible.
Yes, yes.
If you can't get supplies in from there, you can't do anything.
That's right. Well, that was a proof of, you know, to everybody, I think, you sort of realised that.
How long was it before the attack was launched that you started to get this feeling that something big was on the way from the enemy?
Well, you had a feeling, I think, when we were up in the Surtee,
yes,
and all that area, that we've got as far as we're likely to get. Now it's a case of they've got everything there concentrated. We're going to get the hammering next. And you didn't sort of, it wasn't suddenly a battle like Alamein, because we had nothing to fire back at them, really. It was a case they'd suddenly say, right, boom, and they'd move, and you'd get columns coming along that you would have to retreat in front of. That wouldn't be the same type of battle as we got at Gazala and Alamein.
Those were set piece battles, weren't they?
They were set piece. The others, the columns would come, and if you didn't get out of the way, they'd cut you off. And that was the type of thing that was, again, very fluid. Lots of space to manoeuvre to get out of the way. And there were sort of small, fighting patrols were sent out, more or less, or columns, fighting columns. So,
you're getting this feeling that something was going to happen.
Yes.
You're still in the salt marsh area.
That's right, yes. And by then, I think our vehicles were
complete. Yeah,
and we were due to move. This would be about the 19th or 20th, I suppose, of January. By then, about the 19th, I think. From the sound of my engine, the lack of power and whatnot, it was giving up the ghost, and it had to go back. You know, it was no good as a fighting vehicle any longer. So there was me off the road, and they were going to tow the vehicle back to the echelon to see whether the fittest could do anything with it. That would be about a 20-mile tow, I think.
Quite a long way to be towed.
Oh, it is a long way, you see. But there it is. It's across the desert anyway, so it's not, that was not on the roads. And I decided that I didn't want to go back to the echelon, so I asked Matt if I could then become his gunner. And so I'm up there with him, and he agreed. So I changed all my kit onto his car. And my car went back. So again, we were right down now to one car troop.
One car troop?
Yeah. And his car was the only one left, you see. And I did.
Did you operate as a single vehicle? Presumably, in principle, you always had to have at least a pair of cars.
Well, it's always nice to, but you can do. Mm. I mean, providing you were within an area where there's another troop operating. You know, you could say, right, I did that a lot in Italy on my own, where you could be in a position of observation, but you know you've got a troop over there and another one over there, you see, and it's always good to have two, because you've got a slight relief and extra eyes to, But
I would have thought, yes, if you've got two sets of eyes, you can see around corners,
yeah,
which you can't do
with
one. And you've also got mutual support.